It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversation. In today's conversation, we're going to be talking about a new IU Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, which will open in 2023. And the museum is going to present the university's world-class collections of archaeological and ethnographic artifacts, and we'll unpack what that really means in a minute. And we're going to be able to look at collection areas and exhibits and talk through all that. But I think the coolest part of this whole conversation is going to be the idea of an inside-out museum. And so, Ed, I think you're the one that was the one to do that. This is Ed Herman. And Ed, you really are amazing when you think about all that you do with that museum. So go ahead and give us a sense of what that is, that idea of inside out. I'm excited about that.
Sure. Thank you, Mark. And thank you for having me on the show. Very happy to be here. So the IU Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology is the result of a merger. And it's a merger between two successful Indiana University institutions. The first being the Mathers Museum of World Cultures. And as you were saying about unpacking a little bit of those collections, the Mathers Museum was established to essentially bring cultures of the world to Bloomington, Indiana. And the museum itself has collections from around the world that represent cultures of the world. And the other part of the merger is the Glenn Black Laboratory of Archaeology, which really wasn't set up in the original configuration to be a museum, but instead a laboratory of archaeology where research would be done and was also the repository for artifacts from Angel Mounds in the southern part of the state. We can talk a little bit about that some too, but also the repository for artifacts from other areas in the state and other institutions that you might think of that are government institutions. What you were referring to with the idea of the inside-out museum has to do with the way the concept of this museum. As we started thinking about the new museum, we really wanted to focus on accessibility. And when I mean accessibility, I don't just mean accessibility to our collections, but accessibility to everything that we do at the museum. As a university museum, we're charged with considering knowledge, right? We are curators of knowledge. We hold on to knowledge and disseminate it through things like exhibits and online collections. And what's really interesting about it is we also create knowledge because we have laboratories, we do research, we have students that are here, we work with faculty, we work with the local community. And people don't always realize everything that goes into operating a museum. And so much of this is related not only to the objects we have, but also the cultures that we work with, whether it's cultures from China or in Africa or Native American partners that we have and work with right here in North America. So in order to increase the accessibility, we have this concept where areas of the museum that are typically off limits, think about things like the storage areas or 3D photography or the material science laboratory, and these spaces that are sort of black boxes that people don't know much about. Well, we've made all of those accessible. And once we open, we got more than a year probably before we do, people will be able to engage with everything the museum does, whether we're doing research, whether we're working with students, or whether we're actually dealing with creating comparative collections. So that part of it is really very exciting.
That's really exciting. And I have also with us, I've got Nick Warden, who's with Browning Day, and you're an associate architect there. And Nick, this must be a dream for an architect, because it's hard and it's difficult, but architects are artists at heart and creative. And I could only imagine, it'd be a nightmare for an engineer, but it would be a ball for an architect. To imagine how those spaces that we never see, that are some of the most exciting places in the museum, really, for people that work there, for the public to be able to do that. Right. So how do you even approach that as an architect? Because there's not a lot of models out there for this.
Mark, you're right. There aren't a lot of models out there. Ed had a couple examples to share with us from some work he had seen out in the Northwest. But it was really exciting because it allowed us not only to think about the gallery spaces and the public spaces that you would typically experience in museum, but then to think about this lower level, this level that people who entered the museum prior never saw. And to think about that as a public space was really exciting. So our challenge really was to take these two entities, which were separated originally in the design in this lower level, and actually separated by about a 5-foot grade change.
Wow.
And find a creative way to stitch those together. So, we found our kind of two circulation paths that would take visitors to those areas, and then had to efficiently make this very broad corridor filled with windows and glass doors that look into these collection spaces, research spaces, photography, 3D lab, underwater lab, all these different spaces that are down there, again, that were not, accessible before. So that was really exciting to create that experience. And again, just think of that as a public space and just picturing, students or visitors walking through that corridor. And almost something I always thought of was like the night at the museum when they go down into the catacombs of the museum.
Exactly.
And they're walking around having so much fun, just to see all those artifacts that are behind the scenes. So it was a challenge, architecturally, and like you mentioned, for engineers to figure out how do we stitch all this together, make it public, but still keep all the inner workings of all the systems that are needed, and make it look like a great visitor experience.
Yeah, and I would think both of you that one of the challenges when you do that, you talk about a corridor, isn't a way of making that more corridor more museum-like, which is a real trick. And I'm sure you were working with different kinds of angles to try to get different ways where visitors could get kind of out of the way to allow travel and flow. And that's different, but you also mm-hmm. are dealing with, and we can talk about that too, Ed, you've got climate control issues and you've got to keep bugs from the outside from getting in. And I mean, you have a lot of things that people don't realize down there. And so I can imagine separating it on two sides, that becomes an engineering for the HVAC kind of a thing. How do I keep all that? And how do I have open window? I mean, not open windows, but how do I have glass and all that? So talk about some of those challenges. Ed, you want to take a stab at that first? How do you make it museum-like?
Sure. So most important for us is the care necessary for our collections. So when you bring up HVAC, that is absolutely fundamental to what we're doing in the museum. We hold these items in perpetuity for as a trust for the people of Indiana. And in order to make sure that they're taken care of in the long term, it became absolutely imperative that we have the ability to control temperature and humidity, not only for the bugs and the critters that you're talking about, but also to make sure that wooden things don't crack over time and that the instruments we have are well taken care of. And there's a little bit of give and take there. The reality is not every single object can be held at the optimal conditions for that particular object, which means as we designed this facility, we had to take into account the averages that would be part of the best practices for us. And that was tricky business, but of course, paramount and fundamental to what we do. Creating some of those spaces, like you're talking about, as we think about conditions for our objects and artifacts, the critters was actually kind of fun to think about how we could eliminate problems. And if you think, for instance, about ethnographic collections, they come in from different places in the world. They're often shipped in boxes and containers that some critters love to live in. Right. We also have archaeological collections, and by the very nature, they're coming in very dirty, often with microscopic insects or insect eggs, things like this. And we were able to actually design an entrance with sort of like a garage door area and a dock area where we immediately bring the artifacts in, and we have a wet lab right there. So as soon as we offload them, we have a number of sinks with sediment traps, and we're able to actually clean those artifacts before we begin to process them in an analytical space where we do things like bagging and tagging and marking these artifacts.
So that's really, Ed, I think that's what's great about that is you got to design that. So a lot of museums had to figure out how to put that in later, right? You'd have to move it out of one space. But so in a way, I think listeners could imagine that being something they've seen, things where there's an outbreak of a virus in some movie or something, and you have to have this kind of clean area you have to go through, right? Transition clothes, do all that. And you've created that. You've created a way of separating it before it goes and visits all the other collection.
Yeah, exactly. And that was one of the challenges that we handed off, not only to Browning Day, but some of the architects that we work with also at IU. And having that team work together to solve some of these issues for us, we were so lucky to have a team that from Browning Day and Nick, and then that team, that we were very lucky.
So Nick, there are definitely design challenges. We get that, the heating and cooling and all those, and the bugs, and Ed addressed that well. How do I make a museum like for a visitor when you're going through the bowels of the museum, and it's not meant to have a whole lot of people go through it? So how do you convert that to public space?
Sure. So I would say the main thing we did in the public space was to, you know, enhance the finishes a bit more than we did behind the scenes. So we have some nicer flooring in there, and if things are painted, the lighting organized down the corridor, strategically. Again, the main item in that corridor are the large expanses of glass that look into each room, so that kind of, you know, have its cadence as you make your way through the corridor. We also provided at the end of each corridor a window, so there's kind of this continuation of the corridor into the space beyond, which was helpful. But at the same time, you know, with our budget and with kind of the nature of it, we wanted to make it feel like you were also down into a space that was more like a laboratory, more collection storage, that you were actually part of it. You weren't separated in this corridor that was, you know, specifically for visitors. You're kind of part of the action down there and mixing in with everybody, even though you're separated by security, separated by windows, things of that nature. But it really does feel like you're in the inner workings of the museum itself. So I think that's the approach we took.
You are really, you're right there in the inner workings of the museum.
So that brings up a really, I think for me as a museum educator, a really good question. Most of people that are in collections or in research in, you know, in archaeology or preserving things, are not used to being watched around the clock. Not really around the clock, but they're not used to being visible all the time. So you really have gone into the place where people aren't visible and now they're visible. How do you get staff prepared for this?
Yeah, that's a very insightful question, Mark. This is a bit of an issue, and the team, though, has really risen to the occasion. Early on, people were unhappy with the idea of being viewed as if they were in a fishbowl. And this was very early on in the concept of the Inside Out Museum. And I think what happened is, over time, the same people also had the opportunity to help our architects design those spaces. And that really, I think, was instrumental in obtaining support from the team. And some of the people who were perhaps most vocal against the notion early on are now very strong supporters. They really see the benefit in the educational side. And one of the reasons we're turning this museum inside out is we hope to bring more people from the outside in, right?
Right.
And in doing this, we've now, for instance, our wood shop, where our preparators work and our carpenters work to build sets and mounts, and they're going to end up doing a little bit of welding to help us get things mounted properly, and they might be building cases. Well, now the young 10-year-old boy or 12-year-old girl who really likes to be handy with things they do, yet don't really see themselves as museum types, can start to envision themselves working in a museum. And this is exactly the kind of outcomes we're hoping for. That, along with having more people be able to see our collections, and maybe we turn some of the researchers on right here at IU, and they are able to see that our collections pertain to their work or the work of their students. Or even maybe more exciting is to have a group of students who see these objects for the first time and get sort of turned on to studying those, or maybe even studying the culture, or put two and two together to see how these things relate to culture. It just provides so many more opportunities to talk about culture, both in the past with our archaeological collections and cultures from around the world today. And we get people to think about then culture in the future.
It's just inspirational to imagine someone who might not want to go to an archaeological museum because they might go, well, why do I want to look at, you know, things that are dead or have been buried or whatever. Some things are cool. We like to go mummies and that kind of thing. But some things, you know, why would I want to look at a piece of something? However, you are absolutely right. It's that behind scenes that often makes us as museum professionals excited about going to work. And so, you know, it's seeing all the objects that you don't get to see upstairs. It's seeing how things are made. Nick, I know Browning Day, one of the things I know about your organization is that you really design with the client as much as it's possible. And this was a really, I think, a good example of where you were working with people who might have not even have been really appreciative of the ideas at the beginning, but you worked with them to incorporate. So can you describe a little of that process? How do you work with a client who might be resistant to, you know, might be resistant to some of the change you're proposing?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So Mark, as I mentioned previously, we do work with IU architects as well, who are part of the Capital Projects organization at the university. And they also have very good ideas. And we're also on board with this Inside Out Museum. So we were kind of getting that directive as well from them, which helped steer us in this direction. And, you know, just, you know, we took time to kind of meet early on with some conceptual, you know, ideas and discuss more high level with Ed and some select staff, and then the university architects themselves. And then once we got a general layout and some consensus, then we really dove into the specific spaces and the rooms and what kind of casework and sinks, and what kind of tools would you be using in there? You know, where did the, you know, what kind of lighting do you need, and what kind of space and clearances for storage will you need? We really get into that. And that's typical, a way we approach a lot of projects, kind of start from a broad view and then you hone in on the details. But one thing, you know, that was really different for us on this project is that our design phase occurred during the height of the COVID pandemic.
That's right.
And so we had a couple meetings in person, and then we moved to all virtual. And so meeting like we are today, you know, bringing in different teams from Ed's group and trying to meet with them virtually, we it still worked well, and we were able to, you know, show our floor plans via Zoom and kind of mark up diagrams as we went along. So it was a great collaborative effort, and ultimately ended up kind of benefiting our project and its process of design.
Yeah, you know what I've noticed too, and I think, you know, you could have benefited. We've learned, all of us in the businesses we do, like what I'm doing, what we had to do during COVID, we benefited from. And, you know, so some of that, what the markup and being able to see and getting a more participation sometimes happens when you're not in the same room. And so I wonder if you saw any of that when you were meeting with some of the people, where they were more open to a conversation with you via Zoom than they might have been if they had to sit in the same room with others. Is it any different?
I think that's true, yeah. It was, yes. Yeah. So again, doing like markups and getting into our 3D model and live views and looking specifically at things. I think having the smaller groups be able to join and really feel like they were just actively participating, it did have its benefits.
So this is, Ed, you talk about, then you worked with staff and you've got that. So how did you work with visitors during COVID to try to help that, bring that component into the museum?
Sure. So largely we were not working with very many visitors. The facility is closed. If you can imagine, these buildings were sort of put together during this process, and we had to actually remove everything from the buildings, the three buildings that are a part of the museum complex that are now attached to one another in these exciting ways that we're talking about. However, we did work with a number of various stakeholders that are a part of the, who will be visitors to the museum. Right. And in some cases, visitors who might be doing research, visitors who might be teaching. And we started by very early on with groups of people who would help us create the vision for the museum and the mission. So we do have an advisory board as a part of the museum. The advisory board consists of a number of people who are related to Indiana University and some who aren't. As a facility that holds Native American objects, we have four Native Americans who are part of our advisory board. And we also have various professors that represent different departments. And we work very closely, of course, with the anthropology department, who also, that's where archaeology resides as well. And in early on, we had a number of different focus groups that were focused on different topics. And we had a group that was focused on the laboratory. We had another group that was focused on exhibit spaces. Another group that was sort of focused on these open spaces that we were working hard to turn into the Inside Out Museum. And we then had to meet regularly with these groups and try to take different viewpoints into account. And that was a very interesting process, as you can imagine. But the key was that we were able to get very good advice, and people were very happy to provide opinions. And like where Nick was kind of going, we are a product of COVID, and COVID itself has forced us to change a number of things that we were planning to do, and has sort of changed even the flow somewhat of how visitors will be going through the museum. I'm happy to talk more about that if you if you'd like me to.
I would love to. What I think is really interesting about that, that's a really important point. You know, the Indianapolis International Airport, I believe, was being designed at the time that 9/11 was happening, or just thereafter. And I know that the design of that airport was fundamentally different because of that event happening, right? Everybody else was trying to retrofit their airport. But the reason it's so smooth and flows so well there was it was designed knowing that those more strict protocols were going to go into effect. So what you're saying here is a very similar thing. You have, you know, COVID's a terrible thing, but you also had the advantage of the museum not being open yet, so that both Nick, you guys as architects and engineers, also could get a sense of that and what we're going to have to alter. You know, what would be practices going forward, because now we know COVID's not something going away. So how do we, you know, it's going to rear its head every once in a while, or something else will. So how do we, you know, preserve a museum into the future without COVID or another virus, you know, bringing us to our knees? So I'm going to take just a minute break for a second. Those of you who are listening, we're talking to Ed Herman and Nick Warden about the new IU Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, which is opening in 2023. And we'll be back with more after this.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with Edward Herman and Nick Warden. And before we went to the break, Ed, we were talking a little bit about COVID and the effects of COVID and thinking about operations of a museum. And I know many museums across the United States, many that had to actually close and may have been closed permanently, many who then also had to change the way that they were going to operate and do business and that kind of thing. So you were already down in a sense, mm-hmm. right, at that time, and you're going to come back and you're going to open when we hope that, you know, it's better in terms of where we're going. But how did that present different challenges for you?
Yeah. So Mark, I mean, that's a wide open question. We've had, there's so many issues related to the pandemic. And for instance, the American Alliance of Museums, who's our accreditation body in North America, is estimating that about a third of museums that existed, particularly those where people came in right. person to visit, right. will be closed no. in the next few years. So it became very important for us to try to plan around the idea of a pandemic that might stick around for a while. And as you can imagine, some of our spaces, like the large exhibit hall that we break down into a number of galleries using modular walls, we kind of wanted to make sure we had a little more space for people to social distance if that was necessary. So that became something that then had a cascading effect that would require us, for instance, to move some of our cases out into hallways or into congregation areas, which also kind of furthered the notion of this inside-out museum.
Yeah.
So we got lucky in that regard that it sort of fit the concept. But there's other really interesting practical things that happened. So we're doing a virtual reality exhibit that's going to be focused largely on angel mounds. And the exhibit itself, we were planning early on and having the headsets and the headsets that an individual could sort of interact with the programs and have their own unique experience trying to engage with Angel Mounds, right? And it might be a day in the life of people who were there 1,000 years ago, or it might be kind of what the site looks like today. And we decided to avoid that because we did not want to have to deal with the cleaning aspects of it and multiple people using it and checking them out. So what we decided to do, and this came out as sort of a creative response to this problem, is we're going to be installing a large dome. And the dome is about 27 feet in diameter. And inside this dome, we can have socially distanced about 12 to 15 people. More if the people are smaller, right? So when we have kids in classes in there, we're going to be able to get a larger number of people in there. But this dome had other effects that turned out to be really positive for us. For instance, the actual mounds at Angel Mounds are put in place in where they are, in part to watch solar, lunar, and celestial events. So now we have this opportunity that we didn't have before to actually be there and see sort of in three dimensions and experience in a way, virtually, right, what some of these alignments actually look like and whether they're specific days of the year, they're watching the sun, or whether it might be the moon or perhaps the Milky Way. People are going to be able to experience that in a totally unique way, which was something we hadn't planned originally, but turns out to be pretty positive as a side effect of this negative pandemic.
So why that's so exciting is this idea that what you did was, we use the word a lot right now, pivot, but what you had to do is pivot from one idea to another. But in doing that, you created a more immersive experience from my estimation. Because when I'm in a headset, I know I'm in a headset. It doesn't matter how much you do, I can still feel it on my head and it's still not quite the same. What you're doing here is I'm wandering around normally with objects and artifacts, but over me is a celestial change. And so you've got the best of all worlds in there. And so in a way, you created a better experience for the visitor than they might have had in the other one. That's exciting.
Yeah, we certainly hope that's going to be the case. And
I think that will be. It's great.
Yeah.
Nick, what challenge did that make? How did you get a dome in there?
Well, we had an existing footprint to work with. So the dome was more of a size of the space that it was being placed into, but we had to provide the appropriate infrastructure for AV technology and power for the needs of the dome. But Ed and his team have really been working hard on their exhibit design to fit within the confines of the exhibit gallery that we designed and renovated.
So. Is the dome a rear projection system or a front on the dome? Meaning, do you have to try to project across people to get to it, or is you come from behind it?
So there's going to be a small platform, and the platform is about 5 feet. And it's from the platform, so it will not be projected through people or around people, but instead show up from what appears to be only on the wall, but of course it's not. And Nick was being somewhat self-effacing there, because one of the other things they had to do is bring in and make sure we had all the safety aspects that we needed to have inside there. And they had to redesign the fire sprinkler system and some aspects of power. So
Nick, you made it like it was just in, it just happened in a day. It was okay. It's not, it's a really complicated thing when you think about you're putting a dome in a square box, and it's a box that's already existing, and you're trying to figure out, how do I reroute? Just as Ed was saying, there's so much infrastructure in that. And even if it's a lightweight kind of screen kind of mechanism, it's still, that's massive. It's just, how do I even get it in there in pieces to construct it? That's often another problem that architects have to solve especially working in existing spaces. I think it's a really funny story, but you know, at Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, when I was there, they had to move that submarine. That's a, was a monumental feat because it was pushed, you know, it came in through the lake, pushed up on rails and pushed down into it, that location. It took a lot to get it back out and on rails and move to the other side for the architects to figure out how to do that. So you're right. I mean, it's one thing when you're building a building, it's another one when you're going into an existing frame. So I want to give you a lot of kudos to you guys as architects, even though you were, you know, oh, it's just in my day. It's okay. So I know it was more than that. And I know there was a lot, probably a lot of hand wringing and why did they want to do this kind of thing, even though that you're working with the client. Ed, what else was a challenge in that thinking? So that's one where you turned it into something.
So, fantastic. You know, we're still dealing with challenges related to COVID. And in part, one of the great features that has allowed us to create these new spaces is the wonderful invention of compact storage. And these are the storage shelves that run on rails, and they can be basically so close together that there's no space between them, where we used to have aisles that were between 5 and 7 feet wide in order to get our ladders down them and access things. So the compact storage, we were able to secure a wonderful grant that paid for about a quarter of what we ended up receiving and installing in. But today, we're still dealing with a few supply chain issues on the compact storage. So before we can actually bring our objects back in, we have to make sure that the shelving units are secured. And it happens to be this little bracket that they cannot find the proper raw material to manufacture them anymore. So we have to wait for them to come in before we can bring in some of our objects. And that, of course, causes a problem for us when we think about when can we open the museum. We got 5.5 million objects that we will be bringing back, most of those into the museum. And then we have to get them on the shelves. That's going to take months and months for us to be able to do that. We have to make sure we know exactly where every item goes. So we have our registrars working hard on making sure they get everything tracked. Our collections managers are making sure that things are coming back into the museum as we expect. And our curators are trying to make sure that all of the documents and digitization and everything that supports these collections is also in order. So we've had to create new spaces to allow us to do the digitization necessary to eventually, for instance, get our collections online. So, I mean, we don't have enough time in this interview to talk about all the challenges, but.
Well, I think you got there. You know, this is, if somebody's a homeowner and they're moving to a new house and they have movers come in, there are things that are fragile and they're delicate and they have to be handled a certain way, but not everything is. In this case, you're talking about stuff that can't be exposed to the outside air. You've got stuff that has to be handled very, very carefully, but you're not talking about a little bit of moving. You're talking about a lot of moving and then replacing it and not losing things. And that, you know, that's no small task when you're talking about that many objects.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And then we also have the concern about the objects during the everyday business. For instance, our spaces are pretty spread out in the building. And if we need to take an object and have that object be analyzed in our material science laboratory, we didn't want to have to go into the corridor that Nick helped design, that, you know, there might be 100 second graders right, kind of in there. And if we want to carry a 3,000-year-old pot, we don't want to be walking through all the kids.
And you don't want to go out the front door and go around.
Exactly. So no, we right, actually had partway through all of the actual blueprints, we had to come up with a creative way, wow, of allowing our staff to move behind the scenes. So we actually had to create doors in spaces that we weren't expecting so that we didn't have to go out into the hallway and potentially risk danger to our collections or our visitors. So that was another challenge.
Yeah, another challenge. And Nick, from your perspective as an architect, what's really wonderful about now, other than some supply issues, is the wide range artistically that you have to work with as an architect of materials. It's amazing the kinds of things that we could conceive of today, you know, where we only had maybe wood or some metal. We have all kinds of polymers. Mm-hmm. We have all kinds of things. I wanted you to put on your art hat as an artist for a minute, and you're thinking about design and color. How do you process through that, knowing what the right kinds of materials and the right colors are? I don't think it just is real easy. I think, how are you processing that?
Sure, that's a good question, Mark. So we have a great interior design team at Browning Day, and the university is, or Indiana University does as well. So there's a lot of collaboration between those two groups, and then also working with Ed and his staff. There were some existing materials within the facility that we pulled some inspiration from. But as you've heard throughout this, is that this was essentially three separate buildings from three separate time periods.
Right.
That as you walked through it previously, you could tell they were three separate buildings. And that was a challenge. So I think we worked hard to find the best qualities of each. And for example, the original museum had a wood parquet floor. And so we thought that was beautiful and could be refinished, which it was. And we pulled some of that material down the new broad lobby that was created into what was the existing lab. So it started to stitch that together. And then some of the larger doors and windows that you found in the museum, we pulled some of those same finishes and same arrangements of windows into the lab as well. So I think a lot of inspiration came from mainly the Museum of World Cultures portion. And then there were some interesting existing walnut wood that was in the lab that we liked. And we pulled some of that into some accent paneling and into the reception desk. So it was really playing with the existing palette of kind of those base materials for the doors, the flooring. And then where we had some of the new spaces, like the archive reading room and some of the other, some of the rooms that we have a program space and lecture hall, we pulled in some more contemporary carpet and flooring to bring it up to date, but to still blend in and match with the existing finishes that were there.
So the word I love,
the challenge.
But the word that I love that you were using is stitching together, which is something we use a lot of times. People know that now with their iPhone, that it does that automatically when they do a panorama, right? It'll mm-hmm. stitch the photos together. Right. And in a way, that's what you're doing in there. You're trying to get elements, right, that make it not so stark a contrast between one area and the other. Yes, I may know I'm in a different building, but to the visitor, they have things that make them feel familiar and comfortable as they move from one space to another. I think it's brilliant. I just think that's an amazing part of design. And I wanted to make sure we had that point. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations, just like the one we're having today. And we hope that you will listen to the show and share with others and talk and have conversations on your own at home. And we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with Ed Herman and Nick Warden about how cultural museums can actually awaken to their shared humanity in a space that's being merging, which is amazing to me, merging three buildings together into one and creating exhibit space that maybe is different than we've had before. And one of those areas is we've become much more sensitive, and we have a long way to go, but we've become much more sensitive to working with Indigenous people. You know, as it's nothing new to tell you, Ed, but many of our collections came in really, I would say, non-sacred ways and non-careful ways. And so how have you worked with Indigenous people in the museum to design your exhibits?
Thank you, Mark. This is very important to our team and to IU and to our Native American partners that we've been working with. And we do have a long ways to go. We will be working in the future with Indigenous people from other areas of the world, and we hope to utilize them to work with them so that we can tell their story the way they would like to hear it. So over the past about a year and a half, we've been working largely with the removed tribes from Indiana and working with them to discuss how we display or even do research with objects and artifacts that were a part of their culture. You know, we really have no business telling their story. We can from the white perspective, but to tell the story in a much more nuanced, rich, and frankly accurate way, we have to work with the tribal colleagues. And we had a number of people very interested in working with us early on, and a number who, of course, were not very interested in working with a museum or university on these types of projects. But what we ended up doing is getting to a point where we were meeting every Monday morning and every Tuesday afternoon with about eight or nine, with members from about eight or nine different tribes. And in some of the folks could make the morning meetings and other people could only make the afternoon meetings. So that's kind of how that happened. And then we would discuss topics related to objects that we have that there's no way we can possibly display them, to discussing with them how we could sensitively display objects. And that really sort of changed the way we were thinking about doing some of the exhibits themselves and the content within these exhibits. For instance, something we heard consistently was that our regional tribes were very interested in us telling the story that they are still here, that they are vibrant cultures. And while they might not live in Indiana, that's not necessarily their choice. They were forced out over 100 years ago. They had no choice in that matter. And they would like that story told. So as we started designing the museum, and if we hit head on some of these stories that are not, frankly, pleasant, these are stories about genocide and murder and forced removal, that we needed to also design into this museum spaces where people could escape and heal. So we have, for instance, a wellness room where people can go and sort of relax some and get away from a difficult exhibit. So we are hitting some of these ideas of social justice head on, and it actually altered in some ways how we designed the museum.
Yeah, I think that understanding of the visitor needing sometimes space when you hit them with a pretty harsh topic or maybe difficult to understand, and also needing contemplative time in terms of you're giving them a message that they may need to think about a little longer than to be re-stimulated by something totally different. And you're modeling after I had the wonderful, early on when it opened, to go to the Holocaust Museum, which needs, that has spaces designed all through it that are just what you're talking about, Ed, that give you that moment to, there's not a lot in the room, not a lot of color, not a lot of stimuli. So I think that's cool. The second thing that you guys are doing, which is really this inside out part, and it's really exciting, is you're going for the first time, and I don't think I've ever seen, I've seen all kinds of other places, zoos and others do this. I don't think I've ever seen an archaeology lab being visible to the public. Are you the first, or do you know?
No, we are not the first. In fact, we really know good ideas when we steal them. So there are a number of museums who have inched their way into this direction. And then there's a number of museums that are doing this in bolder ways than us.
Wow.
So we are not. However, when museums do that, they are sort of opening themselves up. And one of the things that we're trying to do with, for instance, the Material Science Laboratory, is be able to tell people about the research. And for instance, people will be able to see on a monitor just outside the Material Science Laboratory, whatever it is we might be looking at under the microscopes, and they can see it sort of close up. They might not get, at the moment, a full explanation of what that is, because the researchers are actually there working. But it does expose the research that we do and let people know that there's a lot more going on here than just taking some objects and putting them in a case, that there's a lot more happening, and that the creation of knowledge is a part of what we do. And for many museums, that is the case. But particularly for a university museum, it's of paramount importance that we are focused on the research that we do. And this is in part for our students. We are, we engage with dozens of students every semester. We help fund students. The donors that work with us are often very interested in funding students and student projects. So we're in the enviable position of being able to help in that regard. And all of that is a way for us to not only showcase the research that we do, but also the results of that research.
Yeah, and that inside out goes to what you were talking about with ideas of social justice as well, and you know, things with trying to make sure that we have more women in fields that are like this. And so as I get where you're going, because as you, in a way, subliminally, but you're directing it there, I mean, you're making intent, but as people walk through and they see these things, they go, I didn't even know that was an option for me.
Yeah. Right?
Because really our system has kind of blocked that it was an option to be something like that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think a lot of people know that they can be an architect, honestly. There's some that think that know about architecture, but I don't think they really understand, or all the various levels, Nick, of architecture. You know, you were talking about, you have an interior design team. You have, I mean, there's people that understand materials. There's people. So it's really, I think what you're doing here is you're flipping that, and you're saying, come observe us at our work, and you're probably going to take something away. And it might be way down the road. It'd be hard for us to measure right now. But boy, if we could convert one or two kids to saying that's what they want to do because they saw it, we're spot on. That's a great way of educating people. When I look at that area and making it visible, and I love what you were talking about was, and I would assume this was what the whole team, everybody working together, it was, how do you make things like, what do we want to show? And so it's not just the objects you got into. I want to see what's under a microscope at a given time, but other times it's dead. So what am I going to feed to that? So that must be still a work in progress, but a massive effort to figure out, am I going to have some things up in the glass closer that they can observe? So you now have an exhibit space that's different than you had when you build an exhibit. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, Mark, sorry to interrupt you. There's a great example of that. You know, one of the labs that we're going to show is the Underwater Science Laboratory. And as a part of that lab, so one of the things they do sometimes, and for those of you that are familiar with the Children's Museum in Indianapolis, they had something very similar where the underwater archaeology team would do some of their conservation in that space. And what we'll have is something very similar, where, for instance, we might have a cannon on display, or maybe a series of silver plates. And these silver plates, picture them, they're 16 inches in diameter. They're welded together with barnacles. And what needs to happen is they might need to sit in a slightly acidic solution for a decade. So instead of doing that in a sink, we're going to be doing that in an aquarium, and it's going to give us the opportunity to explain conservation, how conservation actually works, why do we do that that type of conservation, and what does it mean to the actual artifacts themselves over time. And at the same time, the side effect is educating the public, educating our students.
Yeah, you can't just pull these things apart. You know, that'd be the first thing, because they've chemically bonded. And so we get into a little bit of chemistry there, because at that moment, what does it mean to chemically bond something? Well, this is it. So we have to take it apart in a process that actually undoes the chemistry. And that is a long-term process. I like the other ideas that I might want to now come back and see that. And then I come back and it's like, there isn't a whole lot that's changed. And then I come back when I'm, you know, 10 years later, and a lot hasn't changed yet. You know, I mean, there's little changes. And I think that's another message, that the type of research and work that you guys are doing, some of that is very, very long-term. And I don't think a lot of us get that, you know, oh, it comes into the museum and then it's ready for display. No, it's not often.
Yeah, that's so true.
And that's different than the objects that maybe the Children's Museum or somebody else might work with on their normal exhibits. You guys have objects that are very, very fragile, but also have age and have other things that have happened to them. And so I think that's just amazing. The other thing, Nick, that I wanted to ask you before we run out of time is, when you think about this process, what was probably for you the most unusual thing that you had to, as an architect, to do with this? There's maybe many things, but what just pops in your head if I ask you that question?
Most unusual. Well, probably the most challenging was the fact that we had to maintain the extent of collections and laboratories and things of that nature while trying to make it open to the public. So we've added this whole new level of circulation into the space, which made all these rooms smaller, and trying to make up this change in elevation in the lower level with a large ramp, you know, so trying to put all the pieces of the puzzle together so that it worked. They still maintain the same area that was required, but still added this new level of circulation. That was the real challenge. It was also interesting working with all these three separate buildings. And for example, the northernmost portion had no insulation. And as you know, we've discussed, we needed to have complete HVAC control and relative humidity at very specific levels. So, you know, gutting that and then re-insulating the entire wall assembly and really thinking through all the thermal properties of everything. Again, that was definitely a challenge. And, you know, just finding different things throughout construction and all the different pieces and parts of how this facility is put together was all.
Yeah, and that's what really makes your job exciting, and same way for you, Ed. I want to thank both of you, Ed Herman and Nick Warden, for this time that you've been able to spend with us and give us just a very little insight into it. And I hope that I can bring you guys back when we get closer to the opening, or even after we see what the visitors do with a space like that. Until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again, and we'll explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.